Your Honors, the board found that a Gissel bargaining order was necessary in the instant case because petitioner unlawfully discharged Patrick Rocha. However, substantial evidence does not support that. Consequently, the Gissel bargaining order is not warranted, nor is the derivative 8A5 violation findings. We request the court vacate in part, deny enforcement, and it will be supplemental decision order with respect to the 83 discharge and the imposition of the bargaining order and the two derivative 8A5s. Essentially, this case is a remedy in search of an unfair labor practice. It's petitioner's contention the board decided it wanted to force the employer to bargain with the union rather than order a supervised board election, which is a traditional remedy, to establish majority support.
Do you think the ALJ on remand did everything that the board asked in the board's first opinion?
He probably could have done more. I mean, it could have been more explicit. Mm-hmm. I do think with his credibility footnote, he made clear that he was crediting those witnesses to the extent that he mentioned them. And to those that he did not mention, he was discrediting.
Isn't that a standard? That's just a boilerplate footnote, isn't it?
It's a boilerplate footnote, but the board's accepted that in.
But in this case, they specifically sent it back saying that there were some problems, and then in this case, boilerplate wouldn't be good enough.
But that's
right? That's what they said.
Exactly, but that's inconsistent with what they've done in other cases. They've
well, they're entitled to make, I mean, they can agree, go along with boilerplate, but when they find an inconsistency or a problem, they're entitled to go back and say we want more, aren't they? There's no rule that says they can't ask for more.
In order to justify the Gissel, in this case, the board needed to find that the discharge was unlawful and characterize the sporadic, isolated, and largely minimally disruptive 8A1 violations as serious in nature, and that they were disseminated throughout the entire unit, or at least a majority of the unit. And therefore, this still impeded the election process and play free choice that a fair chance of a fair election would be slight, and that traditional remedies would not suffice to undo the harm. But rather engage in a reasoned analysis, the board simply used boilerplate language itself, found in other cases, divorced from the context in the specific case, in order to find that the violation sufficiently undermined union support.
Let me ask you about your contentions here. It did not seem to me that at any place you made an argument that even supposing that the dismissal of Rocha was precipitated by the belief that he was involved in union organizing, he definitely would have, that you met your burden of showing that he would have been fired anyway. Did you make that argument? You deny that it was precipitated by that supposition, but you don't deal with the possibility that the board may rule against you on that issue, it seemed to me.
I thought we dealt with that when we indicated, we demonstrated that he had a terrible performance in productivity issues, and
yes, but that that's not inconsistent with the board's finding that the dismissal was precipitated by the union activity supposition.
And it's our belief that we showed that the board really had no evidence to link Mr. Rocha with union activity other than one statement. I mean,
well, the statement is pretty strong.
It's true,
isn't it? I mean,
but the statement
one can understand they're giving it considerable.
But it's somewhat ambiguous too. It's just
right?
It's just somewhat ambiguous too. It says blow out. It doesn't say initially discharge.
Well, there was context to this. There are a large number of unfair labor practices that the board found that you are not appealing. Correct.
Correct.
And those can, we've said many times, those can all be taken into consideration in right line. Correct.
Correct.
So, just to put this in context, the board found that immediately after Avalar was hired, the service manager Frontella told him that he needed to obtain a withdrawal card from the union, and then he had to give that withdrawal card to Frontella, who made a copy, right?
Right.
Then similarly told the same thing to Paul Seafield. Frontella told him that he would have to obtain a withdrawal card from the union, right? Then in December, they interviewed Rocha, and during the interview, they asked whether he was still a member of the union, mm-hmm. and he responded that he was on withdrawal. And then Nickerson said the dealership would be a non-union shop, right?
Correct.
Okay. Then in December, this guy Higgins applied as a technician, and he's the cousin of the union business agent, right?
Correct.
And he was told that Garcia said, I wanted to hire him, but I couldn't. And Higgins asked if he was being blackballed because he was Breckenridge's cousin, and Garcia responded, pretty much so, right?
Correct.
Okay, and then we get to the big day, March 2nd, and there's a meeting with the union, right?
Yes.
And after that meeting, and all of this is uncontested, Lane goes to Garcia's office. He's called to Garcia's office, right? And all right, and Garcia asked for the names of everyone who attended the union lunch, and whether it was a union meeting, and whether Lane signed a card, and who else signed the card, and who were the organizers. And when Lane refused to answer, Garcia said, well, if the company's picketed, a lot of people are going to get in trouble. Heads would roll, right? All of that. And Garcia threatened that he would run the shop with three people if he had to shut it down. And he had said that the owner would never let the shop be unionized, and he'd rather close the doors. And at that point, the phone call comes in, and Lane overhears Garcia saying, Chris, I'm talking to Lane. Lane overhears Garcia saying that if they found out Rocha and other employees organized the meeting, he would blow them out, right?
Correct.
And that includes other employees, not just Rocha.
Yeah, it was general.
Right. So
were any other employees fired?
No.
But you can't disagree that all of this suggests a context in which anti-union animus is expressed. It's not just once, it's expressed. And it's in that context that the board interprets those words would blow out to mean he would be fired.
Correct.
So there is more to this than just this one interpretation of those words.
Sure.
And so the problem here seems to me what our standard of review is. You have to prove, given your acceptance that the first half of Right Line was met, that you would have fired the employee, not that you could have fired him, right?
Correct.
And the test of that is, would any reasonable juror have reached the board's contrary to conclusion? Not just would we reach a different conclusion, but just was it so unreasonable that the board couldn't have, a reasonable board, a reasonable juror, couldn't reach that decision? So why is it that unreasonable? I understand you have an argument, well, maybe it's a little ambiguous, maybe we don't know exactly what blowout means. I don't know what the other possibilities are. They sound worse, actually. how can we say that the board was unreasonable at this point in saying, well, this is really, as Judge Williams said, this is the precipitating event. He hadn't yet been fired. He was still working there.
Correct. There's the fact that there's the judge's finding that Garcia, in fact, accredited Garcia Zahari to the extent that they said that the decision had been made on the 27th.
Right, so he credited him, although the ALJ also discredited Garcia on a related matter, right? There was
yes.
other testimony, and he said, where he was similarly attempting to sustain something as non-animus, and the ALJ said he's not telling the truth about that. So it's true that I understand why an ALJ might say, well, yeah, he lied to me about this, but he's telling me the truth about this, but the board doesn't have to accept that. If somebody lies about one thing, it's perfectly reasonable to assume that he lied about something else, isn't it?
True. But to the same point, they can credit, and the judge did credit. He saw the witnesses testify. He reviewed all the evidence. I mean, Rocha himself is an extremely incredible witness.
Of course, Rocha himself, though, doesn't matter for this point, right?
No,
the key point is when the decision, at least as it's been framed to us, is when the decision was made. And you have Garcia, And correct me if I'm wrong, I think you also have Zahiri, Nickerson, and Frontella also all saying the decision was made.
On the 27th, yes.
On the 27th, or before, at least before March 2nd. On the Tuesday, is the, if I have my dates correct, Tuesday is the 27th, Friday is the 2nd, Monday is the 5th, Tuesday is the 6th. So I think you have four witnesses who all testify that the decision's made on the 27th.
Correct.
The board's found all four of those witnesses had anti-union animus in other unappealed unfair labor practices all around the same time, right?
True.
And they also, specifically with respect to Zahiri, said, I'm just trying to find a place where he didn't, the court refused to credit Zahiri. With respect to Nickerson, Nickerson, he testified, denying that that he had asked any employee whether he was a member of the union, and the court said that's not true, right?
Yes.
And Garcia testified that he never made a threat to Babian to reduce his wages, and the court said, well, that's not true. He did threaten him. So I think it may be perfectly reasonable for the ALJ to say, well, all right, you lied that time, but not another time, or you had anti-union animus, but I'm not going to regard you as not telling the truth about it. But we have said very explicitly that that it's the board's decision that we review here, not the ALJ's, and the board is entitled to have a different view about the credibility of witnesses, even ones that they don't see, because the board never sees them, as long as it explains its reasons.
Correct, but the board still departed without explanation from its past practice of crediting relying on that credibility footnote. The board also relied on certain documents. It said clearly stated that the discharge occurred on the 5th or 6th, and neither of those documents said that explicitly. And
they don't have to, again, all they have to be is reasonably read as far as we're concerned. They don't have to be clearly read. And those, the documents, at least three of the documents, two of the documents that they're talking about sound like they are, it doesn't seem unreasonable. I appreciate there's more than one reading here. But so one of those is Zahiri's statement that, quote, on the following Monday, March 5th, he did not come in or call, and the decision to terminate him was made. Well, that sounds like it was made on the following Monday, which was March 5th. I mean, why doesn't it sound like that, actually?
Because they used and, they could have been much more explicit and say the decision was made on March 5th or 6th. The other point is, I believe that ALJ was at the scene. He was able to see it. The board simply couldn't. They're simply reaching the conclusion they wish to reach.
So this is a written document?
Yes.
So,
but the document's ambiguous.
And he testified, right?
And he testified.
Did he testify? Were you at the proceeding?
No, I was not.
Okay.
He testified, and the board agent actually took an affidavit from Mr. Zahiri, and they rejected that in favor of his written statement, the statement that was not prepared by him, although he did sign off on it.
Why can't the board, though, faced with an inconsistency between his testimony and what appears to be one reading of this written document, go with the one reading of the written document?
I think it's fair they can do it, but typically the board relies on board agents. They instruct you that they are going to they rely on affidavits and not written statements, and to the extent the statement was inconsistent, they can use the written statement, but their preference is for the affidavit because they can actually judge the credibility of the affiant. They chose to ignore it, which is...
So I don't know, is your view then that any ALJ can make his findings invulnerable by adding a footnote that says what this one said, that the board can...
Absolutely not.
Well, then why... if almost all cases are resolved by testimony before an ALJ, if the ALJ pops one of these, you know, boilerplate footnotes, under what condition would you say it's okay for the board to reverse them?
When there is clear evidence of a link between the statement, for instance, had there been some actual statement by the employer that we discharged Rocha because of his protected concerted activity or something to that effect, clearly.
Why does it have to be clear? Why can't it be a statement? Because if I find out you're in the union, I will blow you out, or I would blow you out, or if we find this out, we would blow them out. Why does it have to be clearer than that? What rule of law says it has to be clearer
than
that?
There's no rule of law, but if the burden is on the employer, the board to...
No, the burden is on, with respect to us, well, first of all, with respect to Rightline, the burden is on the employer in the second stage.
Well, in the first stage, it's on...
Once the evidence of anti-union animus is established, then the burden of rebuttal is on the employer, correct?
Correct.
And that's even at the board stage.
Absolutely.
So, but once we get to us, the board has no burden at all. All it has to show is substantial evidence that the employer did not satisfy the employer's burden.
Correct.
So then that's why I don't see why, when we're reviewing it at this stage, there has to be some kind of clear evidence that the ALJ was wrong in his credibility finding.
Based on our reading of the judge's decision, it wasn't clear to us that he found anything more than that the employer, the board's case could go forward. I don't think he ever explicitly stated that this was a motivating factor. He said the evidence was sufficient to show, and then switched the burden to the book. And then he found the discharge was for...
You didn't challenge at the first stage, did you? You didn't challenge his decision at the first stage to shift the right line burden to you, did you?
We did not make an explicit challenge to the first element.
You didn't challenge that before the board, and I don't read you as having made that challenge to us even, have you?
I think we did. We did indicate that we did not believe he there was an actual finding of anti-union animus by the judge.
Shouldn't have been a right line analysis at all, right? That would be the end of it.
Correct.
Well, you certainly didn't make that argument to the board anyway. That's not an exception.
No, we didn't. Right.
So then we can't consider it, right? The 10E or whatever the section is of the NLRA bars us from considering objection not made before the board. Okay, well, I think we've more than used up your time. If there are more questions. No? Okay, we'll hear from the board. We'll give you some time at the end.
Excuse me. May it please the court, good morning. I'm Jeff Burritt. I'm here on behalf of the National Labor Relations Board. Your Honors, in attempting to meet its affirmative defense under Rightline with respect to the discharge of Mr. Rocha, the company staked out its position and maintained its position throughout these proceedings that it made its discharge decision prior to this March 2nd union lunch, prior to learning about the union activity. They said the discharge decision was made on the 27th. This was based on two things, according to the administrative law judge. This was based on the testimony of Mr. Garcia, and it was based on some unnamed, unspecified documentary evidence. Now, the board,
there's actually, as you're aware, more. There's Garcia's testimony, there's Zahiri's testimony, there's Nickerson's testimony, and there's Frontella's testimony, all four of which state that the decision was made before March 2nd.
Your Honor.
And then there's the documentary evidence is presumably the evidence that shows that he was a terrible employee and had been warned multiple times. And, you know.
Your Honor, I would disagree.
Disagree that he was a terrible employee?
No, certainly not. And the board acknowledges that there were apparent problems
with
his attendance.
Any rational employer would have he got fired from his prior job for the same thing, right? That's in the record.
I believe that's in the record. Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah, and then he gets warned multiple times. Hey, stop taking the long lunches. Show up on time. Don't leave early. And he's warned. The last warning is Monday the 26th, right?
Yes.
And then on Tuesday the 27th, having gotten that third warning, he shows up late again.
It was the testimony of Garcia that the warning was made on the 26th, and it's the testimony that Rocha he countered that.
He said right, that and he countered occur. It, and the ALJ specifically said, I believe Garcia, not Rocha.
That's correct. And then the board, in evaluating
how can that, the board, how can the board overturn that? I don't understand that at all.
The board didn't. The board stated that the judge did not appropriately consider the countervailing evidence, including Roche's testimony that that warning did not occur, as was already has already been discussed.
There's documentary evidence showing that it occurred.
The board questioned
the time records. The guy was not there. 29 out of 30 days, he left early.
Yes, and under the
four times over 2 hour lunches, nine times too long for lunch.
That's
showing
correct.
Up late, not having nearly the hours anyone else did.
That's correct.
And he'd only been there 6 weeks. This was not exactly, or 8 weeks. I guess he started in December, right?
In December, that's correct. Now, certainly,
I just don't understand how it was so obvious the guy was on thin ice. So obvious.
And yet the discharge decision.
And then the discharge decision is somehow viewed as a pretext? I mean, I just...
Well, what it was that the company stood by its position that this decision was made on February 27th, and yet the findings on review after giving the administrative law judge the additional opportunity to firm up his decision and clarify his credibility determinations, which the judge failed to do, led the board to find that this decision, that it was the reason given, a discharge decision on February 27th, was incorrect, was not the case.
That's why it seems to me there's a disconnect between... the principle the board invokes, purports to invoke, and what it actually does. I mean, you say, the board said, this is its final decision, well-established precedent holds that when a respondent's asserted reasons for a discharge are found to be pretextual, the respondent has failed to show that it would have taken the same action absent the employee's protected conduct. Okay, fine. But What the board rejected here was not the respondent's asserted reasons at all. It was the respondent's contentions as to the timing of its action, which seems to me quite different. The way the board has acted here, it looks as if when an employer first contests the proposition that some union activity precipitated a dismissal, and also has a backup argument that even if it did precipitate it, we definitely would have fired him anyway, the board would reject that defense. That I don't know of anything in the law that allows that.
Here, the company did not make that alternative argument. The argument presented to the board was, this is how we went about discharging Rocha. We discharged him on February 27th for these reasons. Could it have made the alternative argument? I mean, it staked out its theory of the case before the administrative law judge and before the board without going into this alternative argument, believing, I suppose, that it could now shift rationales after the fact and go to the second portion of its affirmative defense.
Well, actually,
it
seemed to shift rationales. It seemed to stick with the first rationale.
Well, part of the rationale, but it's changing its story in that, well, we would have done it anyway. But the would have done it anyway is an argument that it's bringing before this court now. It's not an argument that it was bringing before the board. Before the board,
would have fired him anyway is the argument. That's been their consistent position throughout. It would have fired him anyway, and that evidence in support of that is all the evidence that shows that they made the decision on the 27th, when after three counseling sessions, he showed up late again, right? And Garcia talked to Zahiri and got approval.
Well, I believe that the way the company presented their argument was that the board is precluded from finding that this was unlawfully motivated because it predated its knowledge of the union activity. So the alternative argument, we could have done it anyway, they don't develop that argument. They don't develop the argument that even if we hadn't done it on February 27th, the decision was inevitable. The decision had
right.
been made,
I agree.
It was coming.
I agree that I don't see them making that argument, but I do see them making the argument that we made the decision on the 27th,
yes, and
planned to execute it. That's a Tuesday. They plan to execute it Friday.
That's correct.
It doesn't get executed Friday because other things are going on. This is their story, I understand. And so then let's do it Monday. Monday he had left early again, I guess, or wasn't around. And so they actually deliver it that Tuesday, right?
Yes. And if I could address that in turn as well earlier.
On the standard of review question, because this is what this comes down to, is trying to sort this out standard of review-wise, at least for me. The ALJ makes a bunch of factual findings that are credibility, in part credibility-based. We have a swearing contest, essentially. Garcia, Zahiri, Frontella versus nothing, versus the document.
If I could address that, I would very much like to address that.
Yeah, because it is versus nothing, by the way.
I would like to address the testimony of those three individuals. The administrative law judge, as I've already mentioned, made a finding that Garcia testified that the decision predated the union activity, that the decision was made on the 27th. That is the credibility determination that the board then overruled after giving the judge the opportunity to expand on his reasoning, right, which the judge failed to do. Now, Zahiri, there's record evidence suggesting that Zahiri testified to the same thing, but the administrative law judge did not rely on that testimony in either one of his decisions. The administrative law judge refers only to Garcia's testimony and to this documentary evidence. So use that for what it's worth, but the judge didn't rely on that testimony, neither did the board. Now, as far as Frontella, I'm a bit averse about bringing this up because it's not in our brief and it's not in the joint appendix, but Frontella did not testify that the discharge decision was made on February 27th. In fact, Frontella offered specific testimony that he was not told when the discharge decision was made.
It was going to, actually, on JA-165, Frontella, and did you understand that he was going to be terminated anytime soon? Yes, I did. And when was that? It was going to be that week, Friday.
There's testimony on page, unfortunately, I only have a transcript site. It's not in the joint appendix.
Okay,
on transcript site 864, he says the opposite. He says that he was told that they were giving Rocha another chance on the 26th, but that he was not told that the ultimate discharge decision was made on the 27th. Now, as far as the story that the company offers about having this, making the decision to discharge him because he was such an awful employee and yet allowing him to remain employed for several more days.
Stop you on the 864?
Of the transcript.
Yeah, we don't have that.
I apologize. It
makes it really hard on us.
I understand, Your Honor, and that's why I hesitate to bring it up at all.
I'm lying on this thing. I've spent a lot of time on it, and for you to come in here with a different page is annoying.
Your Honor, as I was saying, the story of bringing this, allowing him to wait around for a few more days before the discharge decision was executed, they said he'd be discharged on Friday. Now, Friday was the date that all of this activity occurred. Friday is the date of the blowout threat. The story that the company offers was that they didn't have time to simply discharge him. But they offered no additional evidence to suggest that they were prepared to discharge him on that date. His last paycheck wasn't prepared until the following week. They said that they didn't have time because of an unannounced visit by a Chrysler representative, but that, of course, didn't prevent James Garcia from spending his afternoon interrogating and making threats against three employees in three separate meetings.
See, what I'm getting at here is all these arguments are great for the ALJ. Okay, so the ALJ rejects everything you've just said. Right.
The ALJ didn't address much of what I just said.
Okay, but necessarily rejects what you're saying. Were you at the ALJ hearing?
I was not.
Okay. The ALJ, presumably the attorney, makes these arguments, and the ALJ rejects all these twice. A 9-day trial, I might add.
Yes.
So not some kind of half-baked proceeding, a 9-day trial, and rejects all this. And the board then says, sorry, we're going to disagree with the ALJ, and I just don't know how you do that. What's your best case for when the board's done something like this with a credibility determination of witnesses when it's a swearing contest like this?
I don't have a case to cite to you at the moment, Your Honor. The board clearly has the discretion to find in a preponderance, based on the preponderance of the evidence, to overrule the judge's credibility determinations. Here, they did not just do that. Here, what they did is, although Your Honor finds that the judge implicitly rejected much of this evidence, in fact, the judge didn't address much of this evidence, and the board gave the judge an additional opportunity to do so on remand.
And then he did address new things on remand, but he still said on the key question, he said, Garcia's testimony is credited. The testimony of Garcia and the documentary evidence, as you've pointed out, convinces me that the decision to discharge Rocha was made prior to the union meeting of March 2nd.
Yes, and he failed to explain the basis for that credibility determination yet again. He didn't reference his demeanor by word of demeanor or by his characterizations during the testimony is very
common. Well, he does reference the demeanor. It's just not specific enough. He says, and again, this can go to maybe ALJs are now prohibited from doing these kind of general footnotes.
Not prohibited.
Is that what the board's saying?
No, I don't believe the board is. The case is relied on by the company.
It says he took account. Basically, what the board's saying is the ALJ is lying when the ALJ says, I took account of demeanor.
I believe the
board is saying, no, you didn't.
In the initial
right?
decision.
Is that, am I right in that scenario? The board is saying, no, you didn't take account of demeanor.
No, I don't believe that's what the board is saying. I think they're saying you did not clarify that this was, in fact, a demeanor-based decision with respect to Garcia in particular. You might have, in general, Judge ALJ, considered these various factors, but we want to hear more on this specific key witness that provides this critical testimony to the decision. And yet the judge still repeats the boilerplate reference without going into any of the bases for the credibility determination. In so many decisions, there's in both.
This is a fairly, I've read a lot of these ALJ opinions. This is not, it goes through a lot of the evidence. It seems fairly thorough in terms of describing the various aspects of the case. The ALJ rules for the board on, and for the general counsel on many issues.
Yes, on the.
It's not like this is a rogue ALJ, right?
No, I don't think there's any suggestion of that. But I
there's a little suggestion of that in the second board decision.
Well, there is an interesting issue with this finding of a, and I don't. The board doesn't use the term prima facie, but I believe that's what's been used to discuss this. And this idea that the board met its initial burden to show that the discharge was motivated by animus, and yet still find that the discharge was made days before. The judge never reconciled what seems to be an irreconcilable position.
I don't see why that's irreconcilable. You have prima facie evidence that connects it up. The decision is implemented after the March 2nd comment, so that's prima facie evidence, it would seem to me.
It is, but the board is required to show more than just what we would think of typically as prima facie in other employment contexts. It's not just a showing of several facts that then shifts the burden so the burden can shift back. The burden never shifts back.
Never shifts back.
The board maintains its burden throughout. So to make that initial finding, the employer bears the burden on its affirmative defense, but the ultimate burden of showing that it was unlawfully motivated always rests with the general counsel. And so to find that the discharge decision was motivated by animus, that is a decision that there was knowledge, that there was action taken after that knowledge was gained. So then to go back and suggest, I'm sorry to interrupt.
Well, that didn't strike me as at all irreconcilable. It seems to me that stuff like that happens all the time in our discrimination cases. You show some evidence that connects it up, makes the prima facie case, and then the employer states the reason, the neutral reason why they took the decision. Here the neutral reason is actually we made the decision to fire based on his poor performance, and we made that decision before March 2nd, so it couldn't possibly have been made up based on the March 2nd meeting.
I think that would
And then the question becomes, is that true or not?
I know. And then the question becomes, can any reasonable juror decide that that's true or not? And
right.
And I'm surprised to hear you say that you don't know what to do about the question of what happens when the board and the ALJ disagree with respect to credibility, because we've said that in light of universal camera that we have to go with the board, even when it's a question of credibility.
Your Honor, I'm surprised to hear you say that. If that's the impression I have left, I apologize.
Judge Kavanaugh asked you, do you know of any cases or do you, you know where the board and the ALJ have disagreed on credibility?
Well, I was thinking of too much in specifics, but yes, as we lay out in our brief.
Is there a specific case though?
Well, I mean, to borrow from the judge, it's the general principle from universal camera,
no,
in which case.
There's a specific case, is the Allen versus NLRB case in footnote 6, which specifically says this, citing universal camera. And then for the more general proposition that we're stuck with the board, regardless of whether it disagrees, we said that in Bally's, we said that in Local 702, we said that in Traction Wholesale.
Exceptional circumstance or extraordinary circumstances.
Yes, except in extraordinary circumstances. And I've seen a lot of board decisions disagreeing with the ALJ too, and in this one it's pretty detailed. The board is not only is it detailed, they gave the ALJ a second chance.
Right.
They sent it back for remand. They asked him to do stuff. He didn't do the stuff.
Right.
We agree, if I were you.
I certainly agree with that position. I won't elaborate further. If Your Honors have any questions about the Gissel order.
I do have a question, and that is,
yes, sir.
In the ultimate calculation of back pay, which will cover, probably as a practical matter, a six-year period. Do we assume that Rocha, will the board assume that Rocha went on happily working for the company and the company happily enjoying his services for that six-year period? And also, if the board assumes that, does it assume that he turned up 40 hours a week, or what? What assumptions are made?
Well, these determinations are expressly resolved in the board's compliance proceedings,
I know.
As Your Honor is aware. I would say not. My quick answer would be not necessarily. There are presumptions that have to be drawn, of course, in calculating back pay. There's presumptions about whether an employee would remain employed for the entire period of time. And that presumption is generally offered to discriminatees, that they would have continued to remain a successful employee and everything would have gone fine. Of course, there's interim earnings.
That can be overcome.
But in limited instances, and I cannot point the court to an example, but it's my understanding that in limited instances, possibly from additional transgressions.
What if he hasn't held a job any job for more than 2 months in the 6 years?
I certainly can't say what the board would do in a hypothetical situation. One situation that has arisen in many contexts is when someone lands in jail, or if they pass away.
If
someone passes away, you never know what's going to happen. So there are intervening circumstances that can.
Anything short of those two?
Well, no, I won't say that, but it's not for me to decide. We have competent staff in the regions.
You're much more familiar with what goes on there than we are.
Right. The region engages in quite an extensive investigation. It is a new investigation. It doesn't just jump to the administrative hearing proceeding where they investigate all the circumstances that arose following the discharge in order to determine what presumptions to offer to the discriminatees. Based on this presumption, a compliance specification, which is akin to a complaint, is issued, as well as a notice of hearing. And at that hearing, before an administrative law judge, the opportunity is given to the company to show why this back pay specification or the back pay specification is incorrect.
Do you know whether it's ever included the employee's long-time record as a defective employee of successive employers kicks in?
I know that arguments have been made about the success or lack thereof that discriminatees have had with subsequent employers.
What happens to those arguments?
Well, I don't know. Unfortunately, and I'm not trying to be evasive, I apologize. If I had the answer, I would certainly offer it. I know that that is...
Better not to make one up.
I know that is argued. That's right. I would have a rough afternoon if I did. But has been argued, but I don't know the resolution of...
Can I ask you a question about the board's process here when it disagrees with a credibility determination of an ALJ? Does the board have an oral argument on a case like this? I know it doesn't obviously have the witnesses. Does it have an oral argument?
In extremely rare cases, or fairly frequently, parties will request oral argument before the board, and it is rarely granted.
Did it happen in this case?
It did not happen in this case. No. The board found that because the judge did not adequately explain his decisions.
Each member of the board goes through the testimony?
Well, the deliberative process of the board, of course, is something that I'm not privy to as a member representing the general counsel.
You couldn't put your name on a decision overruling a credibility determination unless you did that.
That's correct. What the board said here and it considered the matter de novo following the judge's failure on remand to offer further elaboration on this credibility finding. So the board said that they gave that de novo review, and I suppose on just broad general principles, the presumptions of regularity, that we can presume that they did what they said they did. There's no indication from the company or otherwise to suggest that they did not consider the record de novo, which would, of course, include reading through the transcript and having that pleasure.
Okay.
I've far exceeded my time. If there's any other questions, of course. Thank you, Your Honors.
Does the petitioner have any more time? Oh yeah. We'll give you another two. We'll give you another 2 minutes if you want it.
Even assuming Rocha was found to have been lawfully discharged, the facts and circumstances of the case suggest that I guess bargaining order is too extreme in this case. At most, there's a one violation, one unlawful discharge, There are two other alleged hallmark violations. Those other two violations, only one was disseminated throughout the unit. The other one was simply heard by one employee. The other violations were spread out over time, were isolated once again, directed at single individuals. The board never connected showed dissemination. They merely asserted that it was likely to have occurred because of the serious hallmark violations. It's not a reasoned analysis just to cite cases without explaining the circumstances. They failed to do it. And in addition to that, the cases cited by the board in general involve more serious violations. There are numerous unlawful discharges, and the cases as such would not be analogous to the incident case. Not what I have. Questions?
Okay, we'll take the matter under advisement. Thank you very much.